dealing with the text, the specific words that are listed as works of the flesh, we spent time in the first lesson just talking about the background or the context of Galatians 5, 19 through 23. Those are the verses we're going to be talking about for the next 12 lessons. And so we're going to deal with the first three there, and they are sexual immorality, impurity, and sensuality. And I found a mistake in the syllabus right away. The syllabus, I think, that got printed out said sexual immorality, uncleanness, and sensuality. So I mixed the New King James Version and the ESV. Sorry about that. I'm going to work with the word impurity, although one of the acceptable translations for it, obviously, is uncleanness. But if you are confused about that because there were two different words, see Debbie. All right. So there should be more to this slide. See if it's going to come up here. Yeah, there we go. So we're going to look at these three words separately. We'll look at sexual immorality first. And this is kind of the process we're going to follow all the way through the works of the flesh. There are more works of the flesh than there are fruit of the Spirit, that is, the different words that are in each list. So we will begin by talking about the meaning of the Greek word that's translated into the various works of the flesh. We'll look at some translation differences. I have a chart that has seven different versions with all of the differences in translation, but it's in Excel, and I haven't figured out how to make it readable and be able to hand it out. I'm working on that, but hopefully that'll happen here pretty quick. And so that's what we'll do. Then we'll look at some of the other passages that use the same Greek word that's translated, for instance, in this case, sexual immorality. And then we'll talk about some illustrations when we finish all three of the words along that process. So sexual immorality is the word porneia. Porneia, E-I is pronounced A in Greek, porneia. And Vine says it means illicit sexual intercourse. There are a number of lexicons that translate or give various definitions, all the way from just immorality, which is a very general term, to sexual immorality, which is still a fairly vague or general term expression, all the way to prostitution or fornication. Our English word fornication is derived from a Latin word, the word fornix. Fornix is a word that means an archway. And the connection between that word and prostitution was that in ancient Rome, prostitutes would find these archways where they would ply their trade, they would invite customers, etc. And so the word fornication is related to prostitution. Some of the earlier versions, like the King James Version, use the word fornication to translate this word porneia. You can see there the ASV, which is a fairly literal translation as well. The New King James Version, I think that's wrong. The New King James Version, I believe, translates sexual immorality. Has somebody got the New King James open? Is it fornication? Yes. If you noted in the first lesson, in the introduction to the lesson, there's a difference in the lists between, say, for instance, the King James Version, New King James Version, and other versions that are translated from better manuscripts. The word adultery, moicheia in the Greek, is at the head of the list of works of the flesh in the King James Version. And later on, down toward the end of that same list of works of the flesh, is murders, phonos. Those words are in that translation, but they're based on some rather late manuscripts. And that's why most of the modern translations, more modern translations, don't include those two words. And if you noted in the lesson one, I suggested that we wouldn't be covering them because I'm going to be using the ESV primarily as a text. So fornication is a word, but that's a word we don't use a whole lot anymore. And one of the reasons I think that some of the newer versions have gotten away from the word fornication is that if you go to Webster's Dictionary, fornication is sexual intercourse between two unmarried people. And that's not a good definition for porneia. And so what some of the newer versions have done is they've tried to become more general by translating, say, for instance, with the phrase sexual immorality. There's a problem with that. And that is, it's not specific enough to give you a good idea of what porneia means. Because all of the words we're going to talk about today, the word impurity, and especially the word sensuality, they are also related to sexual sins. So sexual immorality is a rather general, broad term, but it's really more specific in its meaning, and we'll get into that in the notes. And you may not have them with you or may not have seen them, but in the definition section, I've summarized it in the second listing up here of definitions: sexual intercourse, prostitution. There's a fairly lengthy excerpt from an article that I wrote about porneia a number of years ago, and the whole article is included at the end of lesson two. Hopefully you'll get a chance to read that if you haven't already. I think it'll help you understand the difficulty that we're dealing with in defining this word. Basically, this word porneia is talking about physical sexual contact. In many cases where the word is used in a context, a biblical context, where you can determine exactly its meaning, it involves sexual intercourse. It can refer to prostitution. It can just refer to sexual intercourse, even homosexuality, pedophilia. It would refer to adultery, actually. That's the same kind of thing. All right, questions or comments about that? Is all of this pretty clear? I feel like what's happening is I'm trying to give you information with a fire hose. And unless you're willing to go and take a look at some of the things in the lesson, some of this may not be as clear to you, but I would encourage you to read that article. It'll help you understand why we need to spend time talking about what the meaning of this word is. We're going to do that with all of the words that are works of the flesh. But one of the things that's becoming very, very common now is to define pornography or the use of pornography as porneia. And you can't make that connection from the scriptures, not from the definition of the word. Let me just say, I'm not defending the use of pornography. It's a sin. I think it is described by impurity, the second word that we're going to take a look at. But it doesn't, sexual immorality is much more specific than just the use of pornography. But that's an important question to answer, because there are Christians who are divorcing their spouses because of the use of pornography, because they're saying that's porneia, and porneia is the only cause given in the New Testament for a scriptural divorce. You're familiar with Matthew 5 and verse 32 and Matthew 19 and verse 9. I want you to be aware that there's a fairly emotional argument that I think carries some weight with a lot of people, and that is, if you tell someone, I don't believe that your spouses, and it could be men or women, both are involved in this, that your spouse is using pornography, but that doesn't give you the right to divorce that spouse, all of a sudden you're being accused of minimizing the importance or the seriousness of pornography use. Let the record show, I'm not doing that. It's a sin, it's impurity. I think it's described by impurity. But it's important that we understand, if there's one cause for a scriptural divorce, we need to know what that word means. The difficulty that we're running into, and we will run into it again as we go through the list of the works of the flesh, is that lexicographical definitions don't always give us a good handle on the meaning of a word. Because sometimes words have a range of meanings. Sexual immorality is one of them. And so what we have to do is we start with the dictionary definitions. But then we need to go to context, scriptural passages that will help us understand how the word is used in the scriptures. And in the article that appears at the end of this lesson, you'll see some of the information there, both from the Old Testament, Septuagint version of the Old Testament, and the New Testament. All right, comments or questions? Anybody? Eric?
Basically, it's physical sexual context outside the self or man.
It could be with a married person.
I'm just saying, it's someone not in response.
Someone you're not bound to is the better definition, because you have in Matthew 19, 9b, and in Romans 7, I think it's verse 3, you've got someone who's actually committing adultery, which is a subset of sexual immorality, porneia, with their spouse. So here's someone who has divorced the spouse for an unscriptural cause, and that person, according to Romans 7, remains bound to the first mate. And so when that person goes and marries somebody else, they are now committing adultery with their spouse. That's one of the problems of defining a word by the English definition, or even sometimes lexicons. If you're going to understand what adultery is, and I'm getting off into the weeds here, I didn't mean to do that. But if you're going to understand what adultery is, let Paul define it in Romans 7. Romans 7, Paul will tell you that the definition, he doesn't say, here's the definition, but the definition of adultery there is someone who is having sexual relations with a person that they are not bound to. They may be married to that person, but they're not bound to that person. They're bound to somebody else. Does that make sense to everybody? So it's important that we understand the difference between being married and being bound. You can be married and bound to someone, but you can be bound to one person and married to another. What happens is adultery. Okay? All right, so some different translations here, but the general idea of this word porneia is physical sexual contact. And you'll see that in some of the passages that you can look at, some of the stories that use the word porneia in the Old Testament and New Testament. In the Old Testament, it would be in the Septuagint, obviously. I already mentioned Matthew 5, 32, Matthew 19, 9. The ESV does not contain the second half of Matthew 19, 9. However, Matthew 5, 32 in the ESV does. It's essentially the same in the second half of the verse. John 8, 41, you are doing the works your father did, Jesus says to these Jews who are challenging him. They said to him, we were not born of porneia, sexual immorality. So in this case, sexual immorality would be something that would produce a birth. We have one Father, even God. And I think they're poking at Jesus, to be honest with you, because Jesus was born of a virgin. How many people said, yeah, yeah. That happens all the time. People are born of a virgin. And so the Jews, when Jesus questions their parentage, they come right back at him by saying, we were not born of sexual immorality. But it gives you an idea of what the meaning of the word is. Yes, sir, I don't know your name. Aaron, go ahead.
That actually brings up a question that I have. In Matthew chapter 1, Joseph finds that Mary is with child. Again,
yes.
Setting aside that she's a virgin. In his mind, would that situation fulfill the criteria described in Matthew 19?
Yes. That she had been guilty of sexual immorality. Sexual conduct, physical sexual contact with somebody who had produced this child.
Even though they're not, I mean, it's slightly different than our laws today, but they're betrothed.
Yeah.
Before they come here, finds that she has been sexually involved.
Right.
In the past.
Right.
And then it applies to her.
What he suspects her of is porneia. They were, as you noted, they're betrothed, which is more serious than just our, you know, going steady or being even engaged. It was a contractual obligation, which is why Matthew says he was, Joseph was tempted to put her away secretly or privately. He would have to put her away because they were considered already bound by this contractual betrothal. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I guess, so Jesus is not necessarily implementing entirely new law.
Actually, I think he is. Because the actual punishment for sexual immorality, porneia, in the Old Testament was death, not divorce. Now, by the time of the New Testament, were the Jews carrying out the law? Apparently not. You've got some other factors involved in here. For instance, the Romans didn't permit the Jews to put people to death without permission. But I think Matthew 19:9 is not a repetition or restatement of the old law. I think this is a new law. And that's why I think Jesus says, but I say to you, I think he's saying something different than what the old law had said. All right, we're going to move on if you don't mind. There are three passages there where the word sexual immorality, the phrase porneia is the word, is used. It doesn't really help us a great deal in terms of understanding the word. Romans 1:29, the same thing. Sexual immorality is listed in this list of sins that was characteristic of Gentile society. You know, the New Testament, when the New Testament writers and the inspired preachers and prophets, when they taught people that sexual immorality would keep people out of the kingdom of heaven, that's the end of verse 21. That was a different concept for pagans. Gentile society did not look upon sexual immorality as a bad thing at all. In fact, it was endemic both in Greek and Roman society. So they were preaching something that a lot of people in the pagan world would have said, well, what? That's inconsequential. No, it's not. And that's Paul's point in some of the passages. All right, this is a problem at Corinth, sexual immorality. A man has his father's wife. I think the implication there is relations. When you get to chapter 6, you're dealing obviously with sexual relations. Prostitution seems to also be involved there. If you notice in verse... well, I don't have it here. I thought I had brought it up here as well. But Paul says, he who is joined to a prostitute, a harlot, is one body with her, for the two shall be one flesh. He refers back to Genesis 2, verse 24, as he describes this fornication or sexual immorality in chapter 6. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. 1 Corinthians 7:2, because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman should have her own husband, is the ellipsis there. And as you continue reading in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul immediately moves to sexual responsibilities of husbands and wives. Context there is clearly a sexual act. Now, there are some other passages where sexual immorality is used, but it's used in conjunction with either both of the other two words, impurity and sensuality, or with one of them. And I've, to make that obvious, I've put those words in red. For instance, 2 Corinthians 12:21, we're going to see it again several times, has all three of these words together. And I ask you a question at the end of this lesson for discussion, what the possible conclusions or implications of that might be. If we don't move along, we're not going to get to that. But we'll try to do that. I think in Revelation 2:21, sexual immorality there is literal sexual immorality. And the reason I say that is that sometimes the word porneia is used in a metaphorical sense to talk about unfaithfulness, to use a very general word, of a spiritual nature, that is, worshiping another god as opposed to the god that you are, is your god. Yes?
Ezekiel 16 would be an example of that.
Yes. Ezekiel 16 takes the idea of physical, literal porneia and then makes the application to spiritual adultery is a lot of times the concept because you're dealing with a marriage then. Does everybody understand that porneia can happen without marriage being involved? But then when marriage is involved, you sometimes will end up describing more specifically as adultery. Adultery is a subset of sexual immorality, porneia. Porneia is the more general word. Adultery is the more specific. Hopefully that was clear. But this word porneia is used several times in Revelation, as you might guess, from the context of the book. All right, for some reason I didn't get my titles up here to stay. The second word we want to look at is impurity. You see some of the definitions there. Impurity is one of those words. The word is akatharsia, and it's one of those words that started with a very physical, morally neutral type meaning. It's just the idea of dirt or dirty would be the adjective. Refuse is Bedag's definition of that. And it moved to a moral connotation when something is vile, morally speaking. And so it's translated immorality. That's a pretty general definition. Immorality can be sexual. Doesn't necessarily have to be sexual. Anything that's not according to God's moral standard is immoral, right? So that's a pretty general definition. Uncleanness, Vine says, either physical or moral. He gives definitions for both. The Logos Sense lexicon says, immorality understood especially as dirty and impure, especially used of sexual sins. Now, I've suggested to you that I think the first three sins, works of the flesh, are essentially the same kind of sins. I think they're all talking about sexual sins. But the word impurity can be used in a non-sexual way to talk about something that is considered to be immoral or vile. And as I noted earlier, in the New King James Version, the word here is translated uncleanness, as it is in the American Standard Version and the King James Version. Some other passages, Jesus accuses the scribes and Pharisees of being full of uncleanness. Is he talking about sexual sins? I don't think necessarily, but he just describes them as being unclean. In Romans 1, as Paul's describing Gentile society, he uses the word impurity, just as he did later on in verse 29, use the word porneia. Romans 6:19, for just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity, and a lawlessness leading more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness. We already looked at 2 Corinthians 12:21. All three of these words are there. I'm going to read this verse because it's interesting. This is to the Corinthian church. And Paul says, I fear that when I come again, my God may humble me before you, and I may have to mourn over many of those who sinned earlier and have not repented of the impurity, sexual immorality, and sensuality that they practice. These were problems at Corinth. So whatever they mean, you can draw your conclusions. And some other passages that are likewise lists of sins. Colossians 3:5, sexual immorality, impurity also. They're linked together often. God's not called us for impurity, but in holiness. You get the impression that that's a contrast there. Impurity and holiness are two different things that are opposed to each other. I think that's the point of Paul there in 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 7. All right, let's talk briefly about the third word, and it is the word sensuality. Aselgeia is the way it's pronounced, and Vine says it means wantonness. That's not a word we use a whole lot. Licentiousness and lasciviousness, two more words that we don't use a whole lot. We'll try to give it a little more body here. Is translated filthy conversation in 2 Peter 2:7. I wanted you to hear the note that he says. He says, broadly speaking, aiskrotēs signifies. What he's doing is he's taking some words that are very similar in their meanings, and he's drawing some distinctions between their meanings, okay? So don't worry about the Greek words. It's not important, except that you understand that there's several of them here, and he's talking about the differences between them. He says, broadly speaking, aiskrotēs signifies whatever is disgraceful. Hruparia, I may have missed the accent on that. That which is characterized by moral impurity, malumus, that which is defiled by soiling the clean, aselgeia, that which is an insolent disregard of decency. So as he talks about these words, you see some differences in them, and we'll bring out those differences even more when we get to the questions. Bedag says self-abandonment. That may not be all that helpful. Lonidas says licentious behavior, extreme immorality. Licentious is a word, an adjective that we just don't use. Lascivious is kind of the parallel or the synonym to that, and we just don't use those words hardly. Logos Sense Lexicon says this word means sinful abandon, indulgence in sexual or sensual pleasure, unrestrained by convention or morality. This is someone who says, I don't care. I don't care what people think. I don't care what the moral standards are. I'm going to do what I want to do. So, where is this word used? These are actually translational differences. And again, apart from the New Living Translation, always a paragon of translational accuracy, which translates lustful pleasures. Again, that's kind of general. It doesn't really give us a good handle on what the word means. But here's some other passages. Mark 7, Jesus says this is one of those sins that comes out of the heart. Actually, he's just giving a list. Sin comes from the heart. He's saying it's not from your unclean hands. What defiles you is what comes out of your heart, including sensuality. Romans 13:13, look at the word pairs in Romans 13:13. Let us walk properly as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and sensuality, not in quarreling and jealousy. If you notice, those word pairs are talking about things that are related to one another, and it appears that the second word is actually the cause, in many cases, of the first word. We sometimes would say, oh, this leads to that, but Paul flips that. Drunkenness leads to orgies. Sensuality leads to sexual immorality, and jealousy leads to quarreling. But the fact that he put sexual immorality and sensuality together kind of helps us understand the meaning there. 2 Corinthians 12:21, we've talked about that already. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality, Paul writes, a greedy to practice every kind of impurity. So he puts those two words, links them together. Some other passages here. I have no idea what's missing in the middle there. Let's see if we can get it up there. There it is. 1 Peter 4:3, sensuality, Gentile behavior. Sensuality, passions, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, lawless idolatry. Let's see if there's anything else. Oh, in 2 Peter 2:18, they entice by sensual passions of the flesh. Sensual there looks like an adjective. It's actually a noun. And the New King James Version translates it. Sensuality, given to sensuality, given to passions, separates those two nouns, which is, frankly, probably a better translation. All right, what else? Let's look at some illustrations of some of these words. For instance, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Of course, the temptation is sexual immorality, right? She's saying, come lie with me, okay? And Joseph resists that temptation. How does he do it? Incidentally, we're going to talk about Joseph tonight. Not incidentally. My intention is to talk about Joseph tonight. We're going to kind of do a review of his life to say something about the character of Joseph. I think you'll enjoy it if you're able to be here. So what did Joseph do to avoid the temptation? He said no. Yeah, he said no. Say again. Eventually he flees. You're kind of jumping over something. Yeah, Daniel? Good. That's an excellent point. He doesn't seem to be indecisive. He doesn't seem to waffle. So as Daniel says, he seems prepared to make the decision not to yield to this temptation. Anything else? Yeah, Mike?
Consciousness of God's law.
Good. Consciousness of God's law. Mike must have read some of my outline. but I'm going to talk about that tonight. That he's obviously been taught about what God's law requires. And he's determined not to sin against God, which, that seems to be the motivation, the primary motivation for his resisting the temptation. Anything else that you noticed in the story there? Yeah, Ethan? Very good, very good. He finds ways to avoid situations where he might be tempted, Ethan's comment. And that's the idea of fleeing fornication, right? Not making provision for the flesh, Romans 13:14, sorry. Yes, Zachary.
It strikes me, one thing, it takes a moment to try to reason with her. He doesn't just immediately leave the situation. He does. It's like almost like he cares for them at the house, and he cares for her relationship with the husband as well. That look, this is not right for you to do your work.
You are his wife.
It's like it's not. There's self-protecting himself. It's also, I think, trying to protect her as well. Probably, kind of out of circumstance or like his reasoning. It's taking a moment to reason.
He gives a reason for why he will not yield to her temptation. And in so doing, he may be, at least in part, protecting her. That's your comment, I think we can see that. Any other quick comments? Yeah, David?
I'll build on that. Joseph is really giving Potiphar's wife her chance to escape. He says, your husband has not withheld anything from me.
Right.
So that was her chance to say, oh, I stand corrected, I apologize, whatever.
Didn't work, right? but David makes the point that Joseph is giving her the opportunity to back off from the temptation, not to extend it, but she doesn't do that, as we know from the story. So let's look at another story here. This is the story that's addressed in the bulletin article, the story of Judah and Tamar. What's interesting about that story is, if you recall, Judah ends up having sexual relations with his daughter-in-law, who has disguised herself as a prostitute. Some versions, including the ESV, I believe, say a cult prostitute. He may have assumed that she was a prostitute in a religious sense. Does that make sense to everybody? Many of the pagan religions in their worship involved sexual immorality. And I think maybe Judah thought that's what was going on here. But at any rate, he goes into her, has sexual relations with her. She becomes pregnant. And then it's made known to Judah that she has been guilty of sexual immorality. The word in the Septuagint in verse 24 there of 38 is porneia. And that porneia resulted in a child. Actually, two children being born, twin sons. So there's a passage, there's a story that helps define what porneia is, at least in that context. It involved physical sexual contact, in this case, probably intercourse as well. So there's another illustration of the meaning of some of these words. Take a look at 2 Samuel 11, David and Bathsheba. How's that passage, that story, related to the words that we're talking about? Anybody? David was guilty of sexual immorality, right? I wondered if anybody was going to say, yeah, but also, we know he's guilty of sexual immorality. A child is produced. But is he guilty of impurity? Did he have impure thoughts? I'm sorry? Yeah, I think he clearly had impure thoughts. He is told, informed, when he inquires about this woman that he sees bathing, that she is the wife of actually one of his trusted soldiers, his mighty men, Uriah the Hittite, and he sends for her anyway. And so I think he's basically pushing aside the moral standard of the old law. David knew what the law was. He knew what God's standard of morality was. But in his passion, he pushed that to the side. I think sensuality here is also involved. That's a word that we don't usually associate with King David, right? But the question is, was he guilty of it on this occasion? I would argue yes. All right, so let's take a look at these questions. Apart from their inclusion in the works of the flesh, do you see any relationship between the three sins or works of the flesh considered in this lesson? Well, we've pointed out at least one or two connections, I think, already. Let's review. What connections exist?
Cause and effect relationship between sexuality and sexual immorality.
Okay, there seems to be a building here. It's actually the opposite way. Impurity and sensuality seem to lead to sexual immorality. They all seem to be involved or can be involved in sexual sins, sensuality and sexual immorality, obviously. Impurity is that word that can refer to things that are not sexual in their nature, but that are impure. That's impure is a really broad word when you're talking about sins. You think covetousness is impure? Yeah, yeah. Zachary and then Eric. I think there's a couple of possible reasons for that. One I mentioned earlier, and that is, you're going to get the short version. One of those is that the older translation of fornication was originally associated more with prostitution. Its meaning changed in the English language. We're talking about English translations. So they kind of abandoned that word because it became rather specific, and the word porneia involves more than what the English meaning of the word came to mean. I think that's one thing. Secondly, you know, if you're dealing with a word that can encompass a number of acts that are all physical, sexual contact, whether you're talking about prostitution, whether you're talking about sodomy, pedophilia, lesbianism, you know, all of these things are comprehended in that word. So which one do you choose? Well, what they did is they just gave a general, you know, sexual immorality in general. Well, sexual immorality, it could involve a lot of different things that wouldn't even necessarily involve physical sexual contact. Pornography can be described as sexual immorality, right? It's sexual in its nature, and it's immoral. And that's why people make the connection. The problem is, that's not the way the word's used in the Bible. Okay? But I think those are two reasons. You know, they're trying to decide what to emphasize. And so you'll find translations, read the article, you find translations that talk about whoredom or prostitution. Okay, that's only, you know, one type. All right, I want to share with you a quotation from Barclay's book, Flesh and Spirit. William Barclay wrote a book on flesh and spirit. Farrell Jenkins later on wrote a small book also. But in his book, a lot of times he's just summarizing Barclay. So here's what Barclay says. In the three words with which the list of the works of the flesh opens, Lightfoot, he's now quoting somebody else, Lightfoot sees a climax of evil. Porneia indicates sin within a specific area of life, the area of sexual relationships. A katharsia, impurity, indicates a general defilement of the whole personality, tainting every sphere of life. Aselgeia, that's sensuality, indicates a love of sin so reckless and so audacious that a man has ceased to care what God or man thinks of his actions. A man, he says, may be a kathartos, that's the adjective for impure, unclean, and hides his sin for public opinion and public decency still have some hold on him. But a man does not become a selgus, he doesn't become sensual, until he shocks public decency. As Lightfoot sees it, the essence of aselgeia is that it has come to such a stage of sinning that it makes no attempt whatever to hide or cloak its sin. It is sin lost to shame. This is the person who's gotten to the point where I don't care who knows. I don't care what anybody says. This is what I'm going to do. And that's described as sensual. I'm sorry, you had your hand up before and I forgot. Go ahead. Yeah, that Pride Month. Yeah, exactly. That's a good illustration. All right. Paul combined two or three of these sins and some of the sin lists of the New Testament. We've looked at these in the other passages. What reasonable conclusion can we reach from that fact? It is suggestive. I'm going to answer this pretty quickly here so we can move on. It is suggestive that sexual immorality and impurity are not necessarily always the same things. Here's what I mean. A thumb is a finger, but a finger is not necessarily always a thumb, right? So one thing can fit into two categories where the other one doesn't. Sexual immorality is impurity, but impurity is not necessarily sexual immorality in the meaning of porneia. That's important. Every time we say sexual immorality, we're generalizing again, okay? So someone may be impure, but they stop short of sexual immorality. And when Paul lists these three together, it is suggestive that he's not just repeating himself. He's not giving synonyms. He's talking about three different words that can have three different meanings, okay? We did not get to the question that we really needed to get to, and I'm going to try to do better in our next classes, but it's the last question. I'm going to go past this. What strategy or strategies can we adopt to avoid falling prey to these works of the flesh? I hope that you answered that question. I hope that you looked at that and said, what can I do to avoid falling prey to these sins? Now, we talked about Joseph, we talked about David, and those two stories are suggestive of some things. Can I say this real quickly and then we'll quit for today? You've got to be aware of the danger before you can adequately prepare or defend against it. Women tend to start affairs as a way of replacing or meeting an emotional need. And sometimes they are sucked into a sexual relationship because they started by looking for an emotional satisfaction. You've got to understand the danger before you can defend against it. Okay? So I'll leave it with that. Appreciate your attention, your comments, and we'll go on to lesson three then in the next class on Wednesday.
Is that true, or is it always?
At least in five.